Well, I'm joined now by a voting rights expert on these issues and more. We've talked on the show before, and I'm glad that he is back to help illuminate this issue. New York City voting and civil rights trial attorney Richard Bell, who's also the author of Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. Richard has been practicing law in New York City for more than 30 years, and he served as an election protection attorney in Pennsylvania during the 2020 election. He was on the DNC National Lawyers Council, the Minority Voting Rights Committee, was an electoral poll monitor for the Obama campaign in Philadelphia in 2012, and also an electoral poll monitor for the Clinton campaign in Broward County, Florida, during the 2016 presidential election. He's also argued and won an appeal of a court order protecting voters' rights in New Jersey on election day itself back in 2006. He joins us now, Richard C. Bell. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, very well. Thank you so much for having me back. I always enjoy talking to you about these issues.
I do as well. But man, I wish we didn't have to keep talking about the voting rights being on the not chopping block, but certainly it seems as though the Voting Rights Act of 1965 seems to really constantly be in peril. It's been reauthorized, what, five times? But Section 2 remains, unfortunately, an issue. And what did you make today of the Supreme Court's decision? If you give us a little bit of background on this, these Arizona voting laws that were the subject of the Supreme Court's ruling.
Sure. Anyone who loves voting rights and democracy is not going to like today's opinion, because what happened was the court upheld two Arizona laws that to me are clearly voter suppression laws. One basically disenfranchised mostly voters of color. When they showed up at a wrong precinct, they are properly registered. They cast the ballot in the wrong precinct. And the Arizona law says you have to throw out the ballot, even though they're registered voters, and their vote in many states would have been counted. Also in Arizona, they prevent people in their law, except for a family member or a home attendant, prevent anyone else from delivering an absentee ballot, which you may say, well, what's the difference? Why do you have to gather ballots? Well, in states like Arizona especially, there's a disparate impact on Native Americans, because in the case it was revealed that only about 18% of Arizona Native Americans have postal deliveries that are an hour away from a post office. So what would happen is you would collect it on the tribal land, somebody collected and bring them or mail them, drop them off, and that's no longer allowed by Arizona law. And the Supreme Court thought this was all okay under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act.
So, you know, phrases like ballot harvesting, of course, gives people, they wonder, is this, it obviously, it makes it seem like it is a nefarious prospect. But as you describe it, it's the idea of, look, out of convenience, particularly in areas where people are few and far between, whether there is an issue of the polling locations by virtue of different laws enacted by the states themselves that make it difficult for people to have readily accessible polling locations, that this is not a nefarious type of behavior. This is a matter of convenience to say, hey, I'm going to gather these ballots together. I'm going to drop them off all at once. But the concern, of course, Richard, is that people are pretending to, and they're forging signatures, right? They are just stuffing the ballot with people's presumed purported ballots, and they really aren't that. Is there some way that there could be a happy medium in, of course, addressing that issue, but also allowing people to have the convenience that the state has made necessary by limiting polling locations?
Well, I think when you use the word pretend, that's a great word, because this is a pretend problem. Has it occurred in some limited instances in the history of the nation? Sure. Is it a real problem? No, because you still have the signature matching, or some require the ID with the ballot. There are safeguards here. You just don't get to have one person sign off on all these ballots. There are safeguards that every election system has. So once again, we have a solution in search of a problem, and this is the biggest problem. And on today's opinion, without getting into the legal weeds on it, I have to say that conservatives always talk against judicial activist judges. But if you read today's opinion, Mr. Conservative himself, Justice Alito, he literally is the number one judicial activist in the country, because he rewrote the Voting Rights Act. And, Laura, I want you to know that's not me speaking. I'm going to quote from Justice Kagan, who wrote the dissent, who literally said, the majority mostly made up factors at odds with Section 2, and the court has no right to remake Section 2. You know that in Supreme Court decisions, there's a certain collegiality and a certain respect. Well, I would submit that she has taken off the gloves and she went bare knuckles on them.
You know, I'm so glad that you raised that issue, because it struck me as well as odd that on the one hand it was, look, when Section 5 was gutted, the court said, hey, you know what, Congress, I know you have this formula, but we think that it's no longer not necessarily useful, but the calibration's off here. You got to recalibrate it. I need you to go back and make sure that it's consistent. It's your job to do so. We're not going to create the formula for you. It's your job. You write the laws. We just interpret them, essentially. So we're not going to do that. Here it's, hey, all right, Congress, you've written the law. It's pretty clear what the Section 2 says and what the intention is, but we think it may have written it maybe incorrectly. Is that fair to say that they are doing that? Essentially, we're now we want Congress to revamp this in some way, and we don't think that it says what you say it says. We don't think that's what it really means. And is that what Kagan meant by the rewriting of the law?
Yeah, I think what she meant, if you read the dissent, is this is for Congress to decide, not for the court to rewrite a law that they passed. And not only passed, it is one of the seminal laws in this country upholding democracy and the right of all citizens, especially African Americans and people of color, have been discriminated against in the voting system for over 100 years. And this, the importance of this law is second to none. And Justice Alito decided that he was going to put in some five-factor test. This is completely made up. She used the word. It's mostly made up, because it is. It's made up.
So it wasn't quite the bright line rule, but there were some of the guideposts, right? But the guideposts don't really, the problem with the guideposts, they don't seem to really give peace of mind to maybe the DOJ or others. Because remember, this could, obviously, you know, Section 2 can also be used by private litigants. It doesn't have to just be the Justice Department who's basing a lawsuit against it. Private citizens can also look at Section 2. And so it doesn't seem to help guide, even though they're guidebooks, it doesn't really help guide litigants to figure out whether they have a viable claim, does it?
No, and I'll tell you, let's go over a couple of the guideposts and examples of what's really happening, because basically the court is now giving the green light to these legislatures that are enacting the voter suppression laws. Because let's go over a couple of the guideposts. Alito talks about the size of the burden imposed by the voting rights law. And he says, well, this amendment to the voting rights law was in 1982. So as long as the burden isn't beyond what was required in 1982 that year, then it's probably okay. Well, in 1982, all voters had to vote in person and on election day, except for people in certain states that had an excuse to file an absentee ballot. So that's antiquated. But he's basically saying, hey, you know what? If you stay within those guidelines of 1982, you're probably okay. And then he goes ahead and says, well, look, we have to really see what the size of the disparate impact on the racial group, meaning that whether or not there's intent, does it really affect a racial group more? And he says, well, not in this case. Well, let me tell you something. In this case, regarding that being in the wrong precinct, it turned out that for Black and Brown and Native American people, they were affected double what white people were affected, meaning 1% of their votes were thrown out and 0.5% of white people. It's still double. So what more does he want? That size, to me, if it's double, that's a lot. So that was very troubling. And then, to me, one of the worst things he said was, well, the test is, what is the strength of the state interest? Meaning, well, what would override if there is some kind of impact? And he said that, quote, one strong an entirely legitimate state interest is prevention of fraud. And that is clearly a wink and a nod to the big lie. That's what really concerns me here.
Oh, you know, it's shocking. Really, it's stunning.
Oh, shocking,
isn't it?
Laura. Shocking to use its words. I mean, it's unbelievable. It is such a slap in the face to those that love democracy and voting for all. Not for some, but for all.
Let's unpack it, though. What, I mean, let's give for a moment the benefit of the doubt on this notion. What do you, I mean, let's look at it from a different perspective. Do you really think a Supreme Court justice was giving credence to the big lie? What do you think the real motivation also could have been or may have been instead?
I think Justice Alito, while I agree with almost nothing he ever says, he's a very intelligent man. And his weapons are words. And he is very careful in the words he uses. And when he uses those words and says it's a legitimate state interest in prevention of fraud, he understands that these statutes that are now being challenged in the lower courts are based on, at least in the legislative history, based on the alleged prevention of fraud. And Justice Kagan even addresses this. She talks about, you know, there's a lot of laws on these different areas that are now being enacted in the legislatures, and that's why we have a Section 2 to protect people. So he fully understands that he is giving that green light. Of course, he's not going to say that he's not a legislator and he's not technically a politician, but he is clearly someone, I believe, with an agenda on voting rights, as is the whole Roberts Court, because let's look at the Roberts Court. They took away preclearance in 2013 in Shelby. They took away, for all intents and purposes, the intent test in Abbott versus Perez in 2018, where they said that the legislators have a high presumption of racial innocence and whether or not they intend something racially disparate. And now this test about effect, from this case, I would say they are making the disparate impact results argument a very difficult one.
So do you think that Attorney General Merrick Garland and his announcement last week that they were suing, the Department of Justice was suing the state of Georgia based on the new controversial and newly enacted Georgia laws, he focused and used the word purposeful and intentional as opposed to that resulted in. You know, you have to wonder if something about the oral argument or something about their interpretation of how this court might rule was the reason he did not focus on the results aspect of it. You think that's the case?
Great point, Laura. I think Merrick Garland saw this coming, and he's a very smart and shrewd and highly intellectual and experienced judge. He saw it coming, and he said, look, I got to go the other way with this because I think they're coming at us on this Section 2. So we're going to go with the intent argument in the first instance. Yes, I think you're absolutely correct.
So where do we go from here in terms of, and by we, I'm saying the people who are going to be fighting these cases involving Section 2 violations and the like. And, you know, frankly, the two laws at issue in Arizona, I hate to call them small potatoes compared to, but they're not as egregious, of course, as other laws that have been attempted to be enacted or implemented already or trying to be in other states. I think it's like, 14 other states may have laws that frankly go even beyond the ideas of so-called ballot harvesting or throwing out ballots in the wrong precinct. Is this an indication of any indication at all of how the Supreme Court might, if those cases come before it, how the Supreme Court might rule on those other cases? If they have this approach to these two areas, is the fact that these are not as egregious to people as others signaling that maybe the Supreme Court is not as hostile as people think it is right now to voting rights?
Okay, so we have, I think right now we're up to maybe 17 states, 28 restrictive laws, something like that. It could be 13.
Wow.
You know, it changes by the day, as you and I
know.
So what happened today is not the worst possible decision, okay? That's the good news. It did leave open challenges under Section 2 about disparate impact, but it certainly raised the standard high. It created this new, as Justice Kagan said, made-up factors that make it much more difficult. So I would say that based on the Roberts Court's decisions in 2013, 2018, and today, they are hostile to voting rights in general, I think it's fair to say. And number two, unfortunately, we have a Congress where obviously in choosing between democracy and the filibuster rule right now, we're at the filibuster rule. So I think that we're lawyers. So what do lawyers do? We always fight. So do we take a gut punch today to democracy, in my opinion? Very much so. And are we a little on the ropes? Sure. But that doesn't mean that the match is over. And obviously all these state laws are going to be challenged in court. They may one day reach the Supreme Court. I'm not overly optimistic. I mean, it'll have to be a terrifically tailored argument and a little bit more receptive court, and I don't know where that's going. So I think two things. Number one, as I mentioned, Congress, but we've got big problems. Number one to me right now, voter education. Because if we just get people out there and they just check their registers, they do all the things they need to do and they're educated on it, that's how we can beat this without the
politics. Well, hey, there's in furtherance of education, there's a great book out. It's called Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. It's written by you, Richard Bell, New York City voting and civil rights trial attorney. Again, it's called Voting, The Ultimate Act of Resistance. Thank you, as always, for your time. Look forward to talking to you again. Thank you.
Thanks again, Laura. Such an important issue. Thank you.